This is Bill McKibben from 350.org, and you're listening to WGXE, that's 90.7 on your FM dial, ACRA, putting the community back in radio.
Gig Talk. Gig Talk.
What's new at WGXC? Well, there are a lot less live musical performances on the air, as there are a lot fewer live musical performances anywhere these days. But WGXC has a new show on Thursday nights at 8 p.m. called Gig Talk. Matt Motel and Kevin Shea take your calls about gigs, musical performances, future and past. Call in at 518-622-2598. Talk to Matt Motel and Kevin Shea on Gig Talk, Thursday nights at 8 p.m. on WGXC. It's 518-622-2598. Call in to Gig Talk, Thursday at 8, on the radio at 90.7 FM.
That was a gig problem.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Gemini Construction, a full-service contracting firm specializing in complete electrical construction services. Gemini Construction, serving Greene and surrounding counties for over 40 years. For more information, contact 518-622-9829.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Mark Pollock of Climax New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Wireless Reconnaissance, Broadcast Surveillance, Transmission Art, and more Saturdays on WGXC 90.7 FM Creative Community Radio.
Welcome to Radio Survivor. We're here for the love of radio and sound. My name is Paul Riesmandel.
Hello, everybody. Eric Klein here.
And we're pleased to welcome back to the program our friend, Professor Christopher Terry, who is at the University of Minnesota, where he teaches and researches media law. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
I think we're all here. We made it to another show.
Present and accounted for. I hope everyone in the listening audience is doing well, as well as can be done.
Yeah, as well as can be. So, you know, we're here today because there's definitely been some action around the Federal Communications Commission in areas that we care about that impact radio and impact our media and what we see and hear. The FCC is making an appeal to the Supreme Court about media ownership rules. We're going to talk a bit about network neutrality, also known as open internet regs, because there's been some shifts there that really could affect our ability to freely receive and transmit information over the internet. So that's a couple of things that we wanted to get to, but we have a couple of other things to hit up first.
Well, I just wanted to start the show today by asking Dr. Christopher Terry, our resident expert on the Federal Communications Commission, what the FCC could be doing at this time to make Americans' lives better during the pandemic. What role would a highly functioning, well-oiled government bureaucracy could play during these times, especially when people are depending on, let's say, the internet, right, to access vital services like public school, let alone I could start making a huge list. Chris, what have you been giving this any thought these days?
Yes, and it's actually been a topic that's kind of been circulating at the commission recently. there is a lot of discussion about things that the FCC could do both short and long term. Obviously, the agency's failure to meet the objectives of the National Broadband Plan earlier this year, those were 10-year-long goals for basically universal access, really would have made a significant difference in people's lives as they do a lot online. Before we started, you asked me about this idea that maybe broadcast television could be employed in some way.
Yeah, I saw a tweet
to deliver, deliver lessons.
On my social medias, there was a tweet that went around yesterday, both on Facebook and Twitter, that I saw in numerous places, that was suggesting that wouldn't it be nice if we lived in a world where public school children could turn on their televisions and watch fully educational programming, not like some hybrid commercial, but like fully educational programming to help, you know, supplement what they're losing out on by not being able to attend in-person classes.
It's funny that you say that, because ironically, that was a vision for both radio when radio came online in the 1920s, but also for television when it came online in the late 1940s after World War II. Is that it would be a mechanism for delivering lessons, especially. I'm from Wisconsin originally, as you guys know, and the belief was is that farm kids would be able to work in the fields all day and then listen to radio at night to get their educational lessons, and that was actually seen as a pretty powerful development. Although the FCC could certainly encourage that, it would be very, very difficult for the FCC to mandate something like that. There'd be some First Amendment issues as well as some compelled speech issues with that. Now, if Congress were to tell the FCC to do something like that, that would sort of change the dynamic. There certainly would be some challenges to that. But
you could see like a public
originating
works,
that,
like a public yeah. works administration, like jobs for television producers program where people would be employed to produce highly educational content. You know, but and you know, as part of this government stimulus to preserve jobs.
I certainly spent some time this past week producing content for my students at Minnesota who are going to be doing some remote learning. It's not easy to do. It's very hard to do effectively, and it's very time consuming. So setting aside whether or not we should do it, I certainly think it's a great idea if we could figure out a way to get that content from point A to point B. The problem, of course, is that how are you going to lay out the day? How are you going to get it there? Who's going to actually produce it? Who's going to pay for it?
Who's going to fight over the culture war aspect of
right.
education?
Content. Would I love to be able to turn on the regular television or even the cable system at 2 o'clock and have my junior high level student kids watch math? Yes, that'd be fantastic.
Right. You know, that's interesting.
I can handle the social studies at home.
Yeah.
You mentioned cable, so I distinctly remember growing up in the 80s in Ocean County, New Jersey, and the local community college had a channel on our cable system, and which it actually did broadcast instructional programming was, I believe, directly tied to curricula. And I believe you could take a mostly correspondence course, I think, is what we would have called it then in the pre-internet age.
And
but it was just there; it was just free, and it would have been the type of programming you might have viewed in a class, that was produced, for the purposes of instruction. But I mean, it was just kind of always on, or it was running some kind of bulletin board when it didn't have the programming. I mean, it seems even some of that infrastructure still exists.
Well, certainly PEG channels would have been a great mechanism for the delivery of this kind of content, and then they would have been locally based. You could have just had local teachers come to the local the cable head end and recorded lectures and then run them that way.
Yeah. And what's a PEG channel? Can you tell everyone what a PEG channel is?
Sure. It's the channel that used to show, like, the lunch menu for the local school or community-run cable station. Sometimes it would run, the town boards, things like that. And that would have been a great option for the delivery of that kind of content. But as your probably well aware, most of those stations have been taken off of cable systems because they're not funded anymore.
Yeah, and it would have, they were...
I was actually on the board for one when I was still teaching at Milwaukee, in one of the Milwaukee suburbs, that just got shut down when PEG funding was no longer mandated as part of a cable
many
bill.
Of those stations
they just
are
they had to close it
many
down.
Many of those television stations are still still present and accounted for, but struggling at this time, I think. You know, I think the irony I just want to mention is that all of this programming is available on YouTube at this time, if you know where to look for it, if you like it, but it's, YouTube is such a, it's all things at all times, you know, the internet can be both.
It's a haystack.
Yeah, and so, all this educational programming is there for parents or children who want to access it or can access it or know what to put into the search bar, but... At the same time, there's everything else under the sun is available on that YouTube channel.
I certainly would like to see it be a more proactive situation, but we should have been having this conversation in March rather than now in August, right, as kids are returning to school.
Well, let's turning our attention to a different aspect of the Federal Communications Commission. One of its responsibilities is, really regulating the access to licenses for radio and television in the public interest.
Paul, when you say you mentioned the word licenses, and I wanted to let the listeners know that what you're saying is who has access to the airwaves, who owns the stations.
Right. So exactly, who owns your media, it's thought to have some influence again on what is therefore seen, what is broadcast, what is the content of the programming, and how does that programming serve the communities where television and radio stations are licensed? And Chris, you've been on the show many, many times now over the last 5 years talking about how the FCC has basically failed. It's failed to modernize these rules, which were really first set in place in their most current form in 1996 with the Telecommunications Act of 1996. And the FCC is required by law to regularly update the rules. And part of that mandate comes from the fact that an acknowledgement that the situation on the ground changes, media markets change. But the FCC has bungled it. It continually has had these rules changes challenged in court, principally at the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia, which has consistently struck them down for reasons like that they haven't done sufficient research. They're not really adequately demonstrating what the public interest is in these changes or that they'll have the intended effects. And so the FCC has been, it's been this kind of, sort of like a Charlie Brown and Lucy with the football, right? They keep queuing up to kick the football, only the Third Circuit Court of Appeals keeps pulling it up, mostly because they haven't done their homework. But there's been a new development here, a sort of a fresh development in this legacy of failure. What's going on?
Well, the FCC and the NAB have appealed the case to the Supreme Court. And just about 2 weeks ago now, the response briefs from the Prometheus group, as well as the rest of the citizen petitioners, were due. Now, this gets a little out in the weeds, so just bear with me for a minute. The Third Circuit Court of Appeals has remanded at least part of the FCC's decision four times. That includes the first time, the most significant, which was in 2004, and then subsequent sendbacks in 2011, 2016, and 2019. And what the FCC and the National Association of Broadcasters have done is they are appealing the 2019 decision to the Supreme Court. And as we record this now, the case is pending in front of the Supreme Court, but that's a little misleading. What's actually pending in front of the Supreme Court is a decision by the court on whether or not to hear the case. And this is where what we refer to as granting cert. The court agrees to hear a court case. They grant certiorari to the case before they hear it. And we're at the stage where the court will eventually make a decision on that, probably later this fall. But the response, the FCC and the NAB both sort of attacked the Third Circuit as being this immovable object that they can't get around, that has tied them up and stymied them for going on 18 years now. And they really complained about the fact that they haven't been able to get this case move forward. But in reality, the FCC has not done anything significant to move it forward. In fact, it's quite arguable and quite demonstrable, actually, that the FCC has done everything it could to delay this process. And the most recent example of that is the fact that they've now appealed this to the Supreme Court rather than finish the current and ongoing review that you discussed earlier, which was launched in 2018 and is very much overdue for a decision at this point. But what's the most recent event is that the Prometheus Group and the other citizen petitioners filed a joint response to the FCC and NAB petitions to the Supreme Court to hear the case. Now, two petitions, one from the NAB, one from the FCC. They're very close in design, but they don't exactly touch on the same issues. The FCC making a government argument, the NAB making an industry argument, but they very much hit on the same themes. The response brief, though, makes the point I've made many, many times on the show, and I've made many times in research and in just about any venue I've ever talked about this, is that there's really nothing for the Supreme Court to look at here. This is a basic procedural case. The agency has failed to do what the law mandates that it is supposed to do. And this is both on ownership rules, which it is supposed to review on a regular basis. That was 2 years at first. It's now a 4-year review process. But also on the really important issues dealing with ownership of stations by women and minorities. And where we are at now is that we're waiting to see if the court will actually hear the case. I am very skeptical that the court will take the case and we'll be back to where we were 2 years ago, which is also puts paid on the FCC claims that it's the courts that's delaying this process. But even if the court were to grant cert and hear the case, I don't think the FCC can win this case because it's a largely procedural case. The FCC has not followed the law. I've said that many times, and they have no evidence to support the decisions they've made at various points along the way. And even their minority ownership program, which was introduced in 2017, it's called the Incubator Program, actually has no provision in it that actually awards stations to women who or racial or ethnic minorities. And it's pretty hard to argue that a policy is rational when you find realities like that about it.
So Chris, help us understand here. What is it that the FCC and the NAB are petitioning the court to do? Should they take up the case? Should they grant cert? You know, what is the grand blockage they want removed? What is it? What is the ultimate end result they want to see in our media markets? What's their end goal here?
Well, they'd really like the case to be moved out of the Third Circuit. And whatever their stated goals are, they want to take the case away from the panel. The same three judges have heard the case every time it's come up, essentially on every FCC decision since 2003. And the FCC can't get past that panel because they're not doing their job. So part of the effort here, although it's certainly not explicit, it's maybe implicit in what the FCC is trying to do, is they're trying to get a conclusion to the Prometheus cases as the review mechanism for this. Because
right.
If they move the case back to D.C., the court that normally reviews administrative agency decisions, they're going to get a lot more deference into the decisions that they make. The D.C. Circuit's a lot more friendly,
sure,
if you will. That's oversimplifying it, certainly.
Right. Well, I'm looking down. Yeah. What I'm trying to get to here, Chris, is like through all of this, why should your average person be concerned? The average person who cares about media democracy, right? So is, you know, alert to these issues and cares about ownership and cares about what type of media is broadcast in their communities. How does, I'm trying to break it down to that level. Like what difference hangs in the balance here, that if the NAB and the FCC are able to argue this in the Supreme Court, I mean, what is their objective and what is the difference? How would we perceive that difference? Because what I worry is that this sort of starts to sound like legal maneuvering, and it's hard to put a pin on why it's significant to our democracy. And I'm wondering if you can connect the dots.
Yeah, that's a fair question. There certainly is a little legal maneuvering going on here.
Of course, yes.
But the outcomes of this case really matter. Mm-hmm. The FCC has lost so many times on its attempt to further consolidate ownership rules that if it were to somehow pull out a win or even maybe a draw at the Supreme Court here, the certainly the opportunity for additional consolidation, especially like the type we saw in the late 90s and early 2000s, for your broadcast TV and your broadcast radio outlets that are out there, is certain to come. If the FCC wins this case, or the NAB gets a win by sort of by default, if you will, the ownership proceeding that is standing right now, that is basically unresolved and largely unacted on, will quickly implement new rules for another round of consolidation. Broadcasters made a lot of money immediately in the wake of the consolidation that was launched in 1996. And they've been largely salivating over the idea that we might see another round of consolidation at that level.
And how did they make money? I think this is an important point.
Okay.
Like where did that, how did they make money in the wave of consolidation? How did consolidation result in profit? Because I think there's some people might hear this and say, well, isn't that what we want? Aren't broadcasters having difficulty, so something that would allow them to generate additional profits, wouldn't that be in the public interest?
Yeah, the problem, of course, is that the main way that they made money was through economy of scale and the repurposing of existing content and the reduction in air staff. They reduced the diversity of content. They started producing content not on a local level. So if you were listening to your favorite local music station, it was no longer your favorite local music station. It was one managed regionally or nationally. But larger than that is the diversity issue, especially as it relates to news and information. The fact that this has been tied up for as long as it has, and I am definitely among the people who believes it needs to be resolved. I just don't think that the way the FCC has tried to resolve it is the solution. But there have been some major mergers that would have had some significant consequences for access to information that kind of got caught in the wake of this. And the most obvious example of this is the Sinclair decision. The FCC's 2017 media ownership decision, even industry people were very critical of how it looked in its basic design as a way to get the Sinclair merger, which was tied up in court at the time, over the hump. And, you know, Sinclair, whether you agree with their politics or not, it certainly has a point of view. And their ability to absorb all of the Tribune stations at the time would have meant that there would have been at least one less point of view out there. And certainly the one point of view would have been disseminated even further.
I think it's worth mentioning at this point that the latest Sinclair news, as far as their editorial bent and content, was that they were about to broadcast the YouTube conspiracy plandemic about how the COVID-19 pandemic is all fake, and that was about to be broadcast on the
Sinclair
show across the country on their television stations. They had to walk that back, but it was close.
Well, Sinclair's allowed its point of view, but it definitely has a point of view. They were the network of stations that ran the Stolen Honor documentary against John Kerry back in
Swift
2004.
Boating.
They've had a variety of problems with running news segments that were actually paid for without disclosure. They are actually still under a $13 million fine. As we approach license time, that they have not yet actually paid, on that type of thing. So the larger point, though, is that regardless of whether Sinclair's viewpoint is good or bad, it's that by allowing Sinclair to buy more stations, or allowing any owner to buy more stations, you're reducing the diversity of news production and information and viewpoints. And you don't have to look any further on this than the horrifically low levels of broadcast station ownership by women. Women own about 4% of media in the United States, and racial and ethnic minorities, numbers even worse for them. And those are direct results of the FCC's policies between 1996 and 2010, many of which were then derailed when the court looked at the actual outcomes of that policy. And it's something that the FCC has tried to avoid accountability for over the last few years. And the most recent attempt to do that is to go to the Supreme Court and make sure that it isn't the Third Circuit that's looking over their shoulder as this process continues. But I agree with the citizen petitioners and the Prometheus attorneys here that there is a perfect venue for the FCC to resolve this impasse if it's very concerned, as it said it was in its own briefs, about how long this process is drawn out. There's actually an open proceeding launched almost 2 years ago now that the FCC has not done any significant action in that is designed exactly to resolve these issues on an ongoing basis. And it's very clear that the FCC wants a decision from the court before it makes another decision in the ownership proceeding. My concern is that the FCC is talking out of both sides of its mouth here. It's complaining about the delay, but at the same time, it's doing what it did in 2010 and 2014, and it's basically perpetually extending these reviews without making substantive and supportable decisions that affect us all. I mean, we are talking bread and butter when it comes to political participation and access to information. Broadcast system is still the most important system in the United States. We can talk about the internet all you want, but for Hispanics, adult Hispanics in the United States use radio. 93% of them use radio in a week for access to information. And that is a reality that's still on the ground today. And they have very limited control over stations in the U.S., despite the high level of usage that they engage in.
I just think it's worth underlining what Christopher Terry just told us on Radio Survivor, that despite the fact that Latinos in America depend on the radio maybe more than, more than people who look like me, I start to wonder if the radio even matters anymore, right? Even though I love radio, like we're always talking about commercial radio on the most part, and commercial radio has been so much ignored in my in my listening habits for so long that I forget how important it is out in the rest of the country. And so for Christopher Terry to share with us how important it is for Latinos in the United States, and yet what you're saying is that for the most part, these stations that Latinos depend upon are not owned by people who are Latino. They're owned more by who, I guess, is the question.
Well, they're owned in large part by conglomerates that aren't operating those stations locally. They're operating them on a national or regional basis. But beyond sort of the FCC's arguments here is the reality. The companies that the FCC touts as sort of the positive outcomes of this policy include companies like the defunct Clear Channel empire, but also Cumulus Media. And to keep Cumulus Media intact, the FCC recently had to do something that was basically unthinkable 15 years ago, which was to allow that company to have 100% foreign ownership. Back before the 1996 Telecommunications Act, it was actually illegal for a foreign entity to have majority control of a company that had broadcast stations. It's actually a plot point in the movie Working Girl, of all things. It's actually the plot point in the movie about how the FCC doesn't allow companies to do that. Well, to keep Cumulus's 486 radio stations together as the company basically implodes financially, the FCC approved rules earlier this year that allows the company to basically be owned by people outside of the United States. Now, the FCC very easily could have taken Cumulus's stations, which are in small clusters and small areas, divided that, reclaimed those licenses and reissued them to women and minorities. But the FCC didn't want to do that. They'd much rather pass a rule that would have been illegal 20 years ago.
So right now where we stand, to remind everybody, is that the FCC, alongside the National Association of Broadcasters, the NAB, have appealed this impasse over ownership rules and the FCC's attempts to update them in a particular way that have been struck down as not defensible by the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. The next step then is for the Supreme Court to review this request to see whether or not the court will even take up the review and hold a hearing. If they would choose to do so, then of course then it will go to court there. If they do not, the FCC can choose to remand it back, or you know, simply it does effectively remand back to that Third Circuit Court of Appeals if they say they're not taking it up. Is that pretty much the two ways this can go, Chris?
Yeah, a lot will depend on what the Supreme Court does, obviously, but the timeline here is also of note. The Supreme Court will make a decision on whether or not to hear the case this fall. By the time the court hears the case and makes a decision, we're going to have a presidential election. We're going to have at least one new commissioner at the FCC because Commissioner O'Reilly will no longer be with us by then. So there's a lot on the table on this if it goes. My expectation is that there's not really anything novel in this case that warrants Supreme Court attention. There's certainly not a circuit split. The Third Circuit hasn't really modified its point of view at any point. It's basically said the FCC's always been wrong here. There wasn't sort of a two-on, two-off sort of thing where the Supreme Court would get in and sort of mediate that dispute. And I expect we won't see that the Supreme Court will take the case. I certainly agree with the Prometheus petitioners on that point. But even if they do, by the time we have a ruling, the FCC is going to be different. And by then, the FCC is also going to have to make some action in this pending 2018 proceeding that's going on as well. But if the court doesn't hear the case, where we are is pretty much at the same point, that we're going to have a new FCC and that the FCC will be under the gun to make a decision as part of the 2018 proceeding. But we may see a radically different FCC by the time that comes around. Either way, the court decision is just going to sort of speed up or extend the process. But this process starts again from zero in 2022.
Well, I guess buckle the seatbelts on our easy chairs for this one. The voice you just heard is Dr. Christopher Terry. He teaches media law at the University of Minnesota. This is Radio Survivor. We're here for the love of radio and sound. I'm Paul Riesmandel, and with me is Eric Klein. And Professor Terry is catching us up with some legal things having to do with the FCC, which includes ownership regulations, how it's decided who gets to own radio and television stations and how many they get to own and under what circumstances. We'll also be catching up with network neutrality or open internet in a moment or two. But Chris, you mentioned something in passing, and I'm going to scoop it up and run with it here because I did hear about this, but I haven't followed up on it. So one of the FCC commissioners, Commissioner O'Reilly, who I believe is a Republican, he's up to be renominated, and you just mentioned he's not coming back.
Well, Commissioner O'Reilly's term is about to expire, and Commissioner O'Reilly is a usually fairly solid conservative voice on the commission. The notable thing about Commissioner O'Reilly, two notable things about Commissioner O'Reilly. Commissioner O'Reilly is sort of the resident administrative law nerd at the among the commissioners. He's kind of the nerdiest of the ones. But he's also sort of infamous in the radio side for being a person who actively hunts radio pirates, sort of been one of his sort of chief personal issues while he's been on the commission. The Trump administration, President Trump, specifically renominated Commissioner O'Reilly for another term, and it wasn't expected to be a very controversial renomination. O'Reilly's been on the commission for a while. He's sort of the devil you know, if you will. And this week, as we record this, President Trump rescinded that nomination when Commissioner O'Reilly took a commendably principled stand against the NTIA petition for the FCC to review its the agency authority of Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, something that Commissioner Carr is basically salivating over the prospect of doing.
Can you, Christopher, I don't understand
we're
what
gonna
you
have
just
to, we're going to untangle yeah. that. Yeah.
Okay, sure.
We're going to have to untangle what that is. I mean, I...
Okay, so you're going to have to bear with me here, okay?
Well, let me, if you can, let me take a quick stab at kind of setting it up here, right?
Okay.
So Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act is this little, you know, it's come to more prominence lately, and I think it gets discussed more in newspapers and in news reports than it has been in a long time, because this is the section that in plain terms effectively allows us to have social media, or allows us to have any kind of media platform where average everyday users are contributing things, because it basically indemnifies a Facebook or a Twitter or YouTube or a smaller player from being liable directly for anything someone like you or me or somebody else might post, you know, with regard to any number of different factors. But it could be things like certainly slander or libel, but also a copyright. And, you know, some folks love this section because it basically allows us to have a very relatively free, if sometimes kind of wildly chaotic media on the internet. But there's some folks who would love to see it changed. And they come from a lot of different sides, as I understand of the conversation, because there's certain voices they wish weren't so easily promulgated. Is that a fair summary of
sure.
In plain language
what,
of it?
What Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act does, it's just 26 words long, by the way, it creates an immunity for third-party postings. So if I go on Twitter and I say something defamatory about Eric, something libelous.
What if you doxed me, right? What if you told listeners?
No, not like okay. that. If
just
I,
it
if
has
I,
to be speech. It has to be speech,
yeah,
right?
It okay. has to be speech-orientated. If I went on there and I libeled Eric could still sue me for the defamation that occurred there, but Twitter is not responsible because they aren't the ones who created that content. There's a lot of misinterpretations of how 230 works in practice. And 230's history, of course, a little comes to us from cases from internet companies with names like CompuServe and Prodigy for some time's sake on it. It's actually a section within the Communications Decency Act, which itself was part of the Telecommunications Act of 1996. It still refers to web platforms as internet or interactive computer services for some context. In part, 230 was part of a larger bargain to get Senator James Exson's indecency regulation for the internet added to the 1996 Telecommunications Act. James Exson was one of the authors, but probably the chief proponent of the Communications Decency Act, which essentially would have given the government the authority to enforce indecency rules like they enforced for broadcasters, but on internet content, early internet content, anyway. Exon, very famous for carrying around a blue binder full of printed off pornography from the internet as a way to convince senators to vote for this this aspect. Much of the Communications Decency Act was voted down, but Section 230 survived the Reno v. ACLU decision from the Supreme Court because it actually functions as basically a speech protecting mechanism online. Internet platforms would have to do basically 100% content moderation of every single post if they didn't have some sort of protection like 230 online. you have some weird coalitions on 230. I actually agree with the libertarians far more than on 230 than most folks. That it isn't perfect. Certainly, it's not a perfect provision, but it actually functionally protects an awful lot of speech online. But like with all things that protect speech, there's a fair amount of speech that gets protected that a lot of people object to, just like the First Amendment in practice. But the current debate actually originates with President Trump. He handed down an executive order a few weeks ago that asked questions about whether or not 230 should be quite as stringent as it was, for lack of a better way of explaining it. That has filtered down through the Commerce Department to the NTIA. And
who is the NTIA? Yeah.
They're the administrative agency that handles internet outside of the FCC. They have filed a petition with the FCC now, the National Telecommunications and Information Administration. They're an executive branch agency. They had more of an advisory role than a regulatory role like the FCC, if that makes sense. And the NTIA petition asked it actually is a petition for rulemaking that asked the FCC what authority the FCC would have to enforce content moderation around Section 230. And by this, I mean, it would basically put the FCC in a position of enforcing an online fairness doctrine. On web platforms,
yeah, you'll need to
speech.
The fairness doctrine hasn't been around for a long time, even though it gets raised as a boogeyman inspector regularly. What is the fairness doctrine?
Well, the fairness doctrine actually did was mandate that stations who have a broadcast license cover news and public affairs that were relevant to the local audience for the area that the station served. The Fairness Doctrine is often misinterpreted as requiring something that only applies for political advertising on broadcasters equal time. The proponents of what's going on with 230 and the effort to get the FCC to do something on 230 see the Fairness Doctrine through the boogeyman lens, as you describe. They want the FCC to be in a position where they can enforce sort of one side says this, so we get the right to say this on a platform as well. To be fair, it's coming heavily from the conservative side. Ted Cruz has been on sort of a nameless crusade on this. He hasn't called it the Fairness Doctrine, but he's argued for it in all but name. And what the NTIA provision or petition is about is implementing something that looks like that. Now, the Fairness Doctrine word is is avoided like the plague. But Commissioner O'Reilly's statement, which got him in trouble this week, actually points out that this is the people who are claiming to be free speech defenders. And it looks pretty clear he's pointing the finger at Commissioner Carr are sort of doing so in name only, that they're not true believers in the things that they say, because at least one of the commissioners, and that is Carr, is very excited about the prospect of giving the FCC the ability to moderate and also compel content on various platforms by a reduction in the provisions that 230 protects. So after Commissioner O'Reilly made that statement this week, the Trump administration rescinded its nomination of him because it was seen in some circles as an attack on this idea that the FCC and perhaps even the Federal Trade Commission should be moderating and demanding some sort of equal time or equal playing field, if you will, or for speech on social media platforms.
This is I just want to give context for this week. This is a week in which Facebook and Twitter took down a Trump campaign ad and took down the Trump campaign accounts because Donald Trump stated in these campaign ads in an interview on Fox that children are largely immune to COVID-19, and Twitter and Facebook were both either forced to or chose to. I mean, this is not, we're not going to report this story today, but they were put in the position to censor this ad on their platforms, which
unlike broadcast stations, which have some restrictions on what they can and can't air and what they're required to air in context of political ad, both Facebook and Twitter are privately owned platforms, and the government doesn't really get a say in how they moderate the content. I can start a social media platform and invite 10 of my friends and just have it be my 10 friends talking. And the government has very little to say about that because of the First Amendment. So Commissioner O'Reilly made that point, and he is no longer going to be Commissioner O'Reilly as a result of that. There's no indication that I've seen this week about who might replace him at the commission, but we certainly must be a bit concerned about who that person would be, because they would probably be on a pro-content regulation platform as they come to the FCC. It looks like the FCC is going to proceed. They announced this week as we record this that the agency will take comment on this issue. I've actually been solicited by some folks I normally disagree with to work on a comment on this moving forward, because there's some significant First Amendment but also regulatory concerns on this this proceeding, and you certainly wouldn't want, regardless of where your political views want, you really don't want the government deciding what constitutes actual speech online. That's a really dangerous precedent. Before we went to air today, though, the Federal Trade Commission decided they wanted no part of this deal. And the lead commissioner, the chair of the FCC, said, "We have absolutely zero authority to do what is being asked of us here. So we're just going to stay hands off on this." The Federal Communications Commission, however, is taking comments. There's a 45-day comment window open right now on this issue.
Well, I know that we have one more topic we wanted to get to on today's radio program, but I hope maybe we can come back to this issue.
I've got a quick question on that before we change topics. But my question really is, you know, and I this requires some crystal ball reading, so I apologize in advance, and you can certainly say that you can't see that far in the future, Chris. But you know, would this fairness doctrine of the internet, for all intents and purposes, you know, is this something which is narrowly constituted so that they're really taking aim at your Facebook and Twitter, or is this something which ostensibly covers any internet media, and you know, whether it's so not necessarily
or Google, right? We know that they're Republicans.
Or no, I'm thinking smaller. I'm thinking tremendously smaller. I'm thinking smaller.
To be fair, it is in its inception stages, and we don't know what it'll look like in practice. But it doesn't really matter. It's patently unconstitutional at so many levels that it doesn't matter whether it's small or big. It's so unconstitutional as to fundamentally undermine the First Amendment if it were to pass. I can't imagine a single federal court upholding a final rule on this. You would have a coalition of people about as wide as you could imagine attacking something like this. You'd have people from every political stripe being objecting to this.
We know that there are a lot of successful Republicans in California and Silicon Valley that have a lot of power.
Yeah, I'm not saying it couldn't be done. It would require a massive movement on the part of Congress, the government, and administrative agencies that the likes of which we haven't seen in at least two generations. But functionally, what is being proposed, at least the outline of what's being proposed or asked to be put into place, is just fundamentally unconstitutional. Okay. And setting aside the fact that the FCC has no authority or a very threadbare authority as it relates to Section 230, the petition itself has some fairly technical but awfully thin reaches to give the FCC authority here.
Right.
You can't get around the constitutional issue on it at all.
We have about 11 minutes left in the radio show, and we want to talk about network neutrality. But I hope we can come back to Section 230.
We don't need much time. We can do it. We can do an entire show on 230
if you want.
Oh, my goodness. Unfortunately, we may have to. We are talking with Dr. Christopher Terry, who teaches media law at the University of Minnesota. He's a regular contributor here to Radio Survivor to help us understand what's going on with the FCC and how it might impact, you know, our daily lives, our ability to get information, transmit information, get radio, television, and, of course, how we're speaking to many of you, how we get internet. And so we're talking about network neutrality, which, of course, is the idea that, the internet should be neutral and that all data should be treated equally and not be given fast lanes or slow lanes so that we can all have that kind of equal access to the internet.
UbuWeb gets the same internet as Netflix.
UbuWeb and Netflix on an even playing field. Exactly.
Your community radio station and Spotify have the same access to the airwaves, which is the internet airwaves in this case.
So what had happened is the FCC decided to undo rules that were put in place called the Open Internet Order. So the FCC under Trump's current chairman Ajit Pai undid the Open Internet rules, which had been put in place by his predecessor and that democratically led FCC, obviously under the Obama administration. That was challenged in court, led by a coalition of public interest groups, led by Mozilla Foundation. They're the people who bring you the Firefox web browser. And there were, you know, some provisions a good portion of that of that decision by the FCC was left intact. But as I understand, one part that was taken down was the FCC also tried to assert the fact that it had no authority over to actually assert network neutrality, but then neither did anyone else. And in particular, they were taking aim at states. And the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals said, well, no, that's not the case. The FCC can't have it both ways. They can say they can claim they don't have the right to regulate, but they can't take that right away from the state of California or, you know, the state of Idaho. And Mozilla decided not to further pursue any additional appeals on this, and has decided, you know, they took the hint that the fight for network neutrality lies at the states. But we've had some developments in this again, Chris.
Yes, as we record this week, the California law, the California net neutrality law, has come up in court. Now, this case has been pending since this battle broke out back in 2017, actually. California quickly passed a state law guaranteeing net neutrality within the state borders, and the lawsuit related to that was put on hold while the other cases worked themselves out. Mozilla decided not to ask for a Supreme Court review, in part because of the three issues that were remanded. The FCC wasn't really done on net neutrality, so they might be saving their saving the Supreme Court appeal for next time. But this week, the Trump administration went to war with California in the case, which is now moving forward. And they actually, the Trump administration actually is still arguing that they have the authority to preempt state law, even though the D.C. Circuit said, as you correctly describe it, you can't have it both ways. If you declare broadband to be a Title II service, you have all the authority. But if you say it's not a Title II service, then you don't have any authority and you can't preempt state law. And this was a significant part of the decision. The FCC nominally wins in Mozilla, but the preemption issue, one of the three issues that is actually remanded in the case, actually largely undermines the FCC's action on net neutrality, because any state would be free to regulate it on an intra-state basis. And several states have passed laws, including California, which was the first to do so. This is going to make a bigger mess of this situation for the FCC than they ever intended this to be, certainly, as they're potentially going to have to fight over this power potentially as many as 50 times. 22 states were originally parties to the Mozilla case, including Minnesota, where I am. And there's state laws in at least six states that I'm aware of that guarantee intrastate net neutrality of the type that had been guaranteed by the Title II order. So this case is significant. A, it's in California and it's in federal court, but it's going to be the precedent for at least part of the case that will eventually make it to the Supreme Court on this issue, assuming that a newly constituted FCC next year doesn't do exactly what the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals said it could do, which was revert back to the thrice approved 2015 rules, which imposed Title II.
What so the court said, the open internet rules, essentially.
Yeah, the open internet rules from 2015. What the court said in Mozilla is that the FCC was making a policy choice not to enforce Title II, but that it wasn't that the original Title II rules, which even the Supreme Court had a chance to review, were invalid. It's just that the FCC had the authority as the agency that's in charge of this to make a policy decision about which way was better. The PI FCC decided the way that favored ISPs over citizens was better than the Title II, which are more utility-style regulations.
So in this challenge to the California law, you said the Trump administration has stepped in. How did it do so? What arm of the administration has stepped in?
Well, any time that the federal government is arguing with the state, it's actually the Department of Justice that does the arguing on behalf of the government. Yeah, so it's not... It wasn't specific to the Trump administration per se, as much as it is that they're the group in power.
And the DOJ brought the suit, or they've joined the suit?
The DOJ brought the suit on behalf of the government and the FCC.
And this is a new suit, or is this is a?
No, it's actually been pending since California passed the law.
Okay.
The lawsuit was put on hold pending an outcome of the Mozilla decision. Mozilla's decision in the last couple of weeks to not ask for the Supreme Court review allows this case to move forward. And it's actually moving pretty quickly since Mozilla announced that decision.
So then again, this is the Trump administration through the Department of Justice arguing that the FCC cannot enforce network neutrality in open internet, but and in part saying that it has no authority to do so, or it chooses not to take up the legal provision that would grant that authority. But if they can't have that authority, they're also arguing the states can't either. Something which is already, as you note, struck down by the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which says, they can't have it both ways. Either the FCC can say we have authority and therefore we can institute open internet, and I suspect therefore might maybe also take precedence on state rules, or we have no authority, in which case it's open season for a state, for instance, to assert that authority. So
And it's important to note that the D.C. Circuit panel, the original panel in Mozilla, said that crystal clear. It might have been the one thing that all three of the judges on the panel agreed with, and the case was appealed to the full D.C. Circuit and banc review, and the court didn't take the case at that level, meaning that the panel decision was still valid.
They thought it was good. Yeah.
So it's pretty clear that the decision is actually right in legal terms. The FCC can't have it both ways. The fact that it was allowed to put in the open internet rules in 2015 under Tom Wheeler was because they had reclassified broadband under Title II. And it's important to note that it was actually the D.C. Circuit that told the FCC if it wanted to have any kind of net neutrality rules and to have the authority to enforce those, that it would have to reclassify broadband under Title II. It said that in the Verizon decision, which actually overturned the FCC's previous net neutrality order
because they didn't
in 2014.
Yeah, so basically it comes down to this. The FCC has a lever it can pull. On the position, it says that the internet's a utility and therefore they can enforce an open internet and network neutrality. In the off position, it says the internet is not a utility, like telephone, for instance, and therefore they give up, they lose authority, but they willfully give up the authority to regulate network neutrality, and they want to put it in the off position. In the current administration, the D.C. Circuit Appeal says you can choose either position; it just has outcomes. You choose. It's a choose-your-own-adventure. Either way is valid. They're basically it's a policy decision. It's one which they don't believe is otherwise impacted by other court precedent or by the Constitution at some high level or other laws. But you choose your adventure. In the on position, it's Title II. It's a utility. You can have network neutrality. In the off position, it's the other way. The FCC chooses, but there are consequences to the choice.
It's an extremely high-stakes choice.
Yes, it's extremely high stakes.
Extremely high stakes, but one of the problems with the Mozilla decision is it doesn't actually resolve this dispute.